Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
A Virgil Kane is her name, and I served on a Danville train to Stonemaid's Cavalry Camp and tore up the tracks again.
It's December 29th, 1971. The band is in the midst of a four-night stand at the New York Academy of Music. Alan Toussaint is on horns, Robbie Robertson is loose and relaxed, and on New Year's Eve, Bob Dylan will step up on stage to sing songs like this.
Once upon a time you dress so fine, through the bones of down in your grind, then you
Rolling Stone recently declared the band's 1971 concert one of its top 50 of all time. They quoted Levon Helm as saying, "It was the most fun I ever had making a band record." Today, we've gathered a kind of eclectic group of music lovers to talk about what makes a concert sublime and memorable. What is it about one show out of the dozens or hundreds of concerts that we've seen that is transformational in some way, and that made us see and experience music differently? And I hope you'll join in on social media. Is there a single concert that stands above all others for you? Tell me who, when, and where on Twitter, at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Okay, I have to say we have kind of half a roundtable today because one of our guests couldn't show, but that doesn't mean this isn't going to be fun and lively and full of music. Ty Coleman is with us, an assistant professor of English literature at St. Kate's. Great to have you back.
Great to be back. Thank you so much.
Mayor Chris Coleman is here, a big-time music lover, and yes, it's the Coleman. It's the Coleman Roundtable. It's how it had to be.
The Coleman Clutch.
That's right.
That's right. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So I use first names on the roundtable, so forgive the mayor
Don't worry,
part of that.
Yeah, it's okay. That's my name.
I think concerts are like the anticipation that you feel about vacation travel. Maybe the most of the pleasure is anticipating the moment that you're going to be at that concert and the band is going to play the first opening note. Do you buy this?
Well, there's certainly a part of, you know, that whole you're getting psyched, you're geared up, you know, especially when you were younger and you didn't have 14,000 things that you had to do ahead of time.
Right.
And you could just, you know, you'd spent the whole day listening to this, to the group that you were going to go hear, and, you know, and you know, get together with friends and maybe have a drink beforehand. It was, you know, it's all incredible. But when that first note hits, you know, when the band walks out on stage and usually, hopefully they say, "Hello, St. Paul."
And they all do, whether they know where they're at or not.
Right, exactly. But, you know, and then you're kind of transformed and it's magical.
It is magical. Why? I mean, what is it about the moment? What is it that happens in a room with a live performance that doesn't happen in all the other ways that we have to access music?
Well, you know, obviously there's the you know, auditory piece of a concert, but there's the visual pieces of it. And I think actually sometimes concerts go too far on the visual sides of it.
Agree. We'll talk about that in a second.
But then there's just that physical, you know, pulse that's hitting you. You know, you get the bass notes that are you know, you're feeling it. You're not just hearing it. You're actually feeling it, and particularly live. And then you're seeing the reactions of all the folks that are around you. If the musicians are hitting it and the people are feeling it, it captures something that you can't capture when you're listening to something through headphones.
Ty, what is it about being in the room? I mean, we have so many ways to experience music now, right? We can call up any video we want on YouTube. What is it about being in the room?
I think it's affirmation of who you are. I mean, I'm dating myself. I think it was 2004, the Excel concert. It was Prince.
I saw it.
And the Time opened.
Yeah.
And I was there with my best girlfriend. And we didn't know that the Time, they were opening. And you heard that syncopated rhythm, that beat. And we just started screaming. And everybody started screaming like, "Oh, my God." And I feel it's that sense of where it affirms who you are because you're connected with that artist, you're connected to that music, you've gone out of your way to invest in a ticket, which goes beyond even buying the music, and then you're in a room with probably thousands of people, and it just like affirms who you are, where you were at that moment, how you felt, and then everything that comes out of that. So it just magnifies you out of yourself.
It is something, and I argue that I think that happens whether it's a venue where there's thousands and thousands of people or the Fitzgerald Theater in a special moment with 1,000 people. There is something about sitting shoulder to shoulder with someone else experiencing something that is kind of unpredictable.
Right. It's like a connection, right? I mean, I've heard people say, you know, the lie is that we think we aren't connected, but the truth is that we want to be connected and we are. And it's in that moment you find this vehicle that connects everybody in the room. You don't know who they are, but you've connected to it. And it's like a high you can't even imagine, right? And I think it happens not only when you're in a live performance where you're actually there in the room, but even a live performance that you might see performed on TV or some other medium, especially if that song is talking about issues outside of yourself, like political issues, historical issues, et cetera, et cetera.
Chris?
Well, first of all, I think exchanging sweat with people that you don't know in a hot, you know, on the dance floor of a club. And I agree with you. It's not the 18,000 seat arenas. It's the small clubs. I mean, you go to the Turf Club and you see a show or now the Palace Theater and you know, what I love about the Palace Theater is that you've got the floor where you can stand with folks, and then you've got the seats up on the balcony where you can sit and listen to it. And so you can experience, people can experience the exact same concert in two completely different ways,
right.
That kind of suit their personality and all of that. It's like you're in the club, you know, if you're at the show with someone, you know, whether you know them or not, they're part of the same club that you're part of.
Okay, so this is what I wanted to talk about, that sense of inclusivity with, again, Ty, with what you said, without necessarily knowing who's standing around you, but for a pretty unique moment for 2 hours, there is this strong sense of inclusiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really hard to get that experience in a lot of other places.
I would agree. I mean, in that Prince concert, my husband, he was just, you know, wasn't a Prince fan, but we still love him. I think he looked at me like, Ty, you have lost your mind. Like, I knew every single word. I stood the entire time, and then everybody else knew every single word. And I think, you know, at the risk of sounding hokey, music is that medium. I don't think it's a coincidence that music verse existed before everything.
Right.
So it's something about that reminds us, I think, who we are and how we're supposed to be connected.
Now, Chris, a minute ago you said some of the bands have gone over the top, and I want to talk about that because sometimes as a concert goer, I feel like the stripped down, quieter moments are more important than the pyrotechnics and the drama and the costumes and all that. But it seems like the bands have gone that way because they think that's what the audience wants.
Well, I mean, some artists are not just musicians, they're performers, and they are dancers, and they are, you know, it's a Broadway production. It's not just a concert in the way that the band, you know, was in The Last Waltz. So I want to be fair to them because it's, you know, that's what they do. It's not just about the music.
You mean when a performer brings the dancers and the
I mean, Lady Gaga isn't just about Lady Gaga singing. Lady Gaga is a show.
I've never seen her in concert.
And
have
you should know my 7-year-old is still talking about the Super Bowl where she flew in.
Oh no, no,
with cable wires.
Right. So that's like Spider-Man on Broadway. I mean
exactly.
Is hopefully without the accidents, she's a show. But when you're seeing a performer that really is about the music and they've got, you know, big screens and you feel, you know, almost, it's almost distracting because instead of watching the performer or the group on the stage, you might as well be home watching it on TV.
Right. You feel disconnected in some ways to the experience between the artist and the audience.
Yeah, every once in a while you have to kind of remind yourself, oh, wait, there's actually a live person singing up on stage. I don't have to look at the TV screen behind their head. I mean, that's great if you're in the balcony. It's nice to be able to see up close and all those things. But you know, you have to be, I think you just have to get yourself in the moment and be part and be present in the concert, and I think sometimes the other pieces of it distract from being present with the artist.
Okay, you just said something pretty important there, which is this idea of being present.
If you're texting during a concert, you're an idiot, but that's, you know, you've just wasted a lot of money. The worst thing in the world is to be behind someone who's filming the whole thing.
Yeah.
And they've got their
yes.
phone up, and it's like, just be present in the moment of this experience, and, you know, I don't care that you're going to show me clips of it later on.
Right, and we might be in this moment where we think this, you know, this show is about music, but we're also acknowledging maybe there's been an aesthetic, right? There's music and there's something else. And like you, I want to give it that, you know, I want to acknowledge that's okay, but I'm with you. It should be with you and the music. I mean, I remember watching Whitney Houston, and I remember thinking, wow, she can't really dance that well.
Yeah.
But I didn't care, because really? When she started singing, I started crying.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my focus. And I remember leaning over and telling my boyfriend at the time, well, she doesn't have to dance. She can sing. But then take somebody like Beyonce and Lemonade, right? Like,
yeah.
Clearly she can sing, but she can also dance, right? So it is complicated. It's layered.
I saw Adele when she played at the kind of the Half Bowl at the X, so it was about 6,000 people, and she had just emerged from, you know, she had canceled actually a concert at First Avenue because she had gotten so...
The throat surgery, or...?
No, just because she had become so big from the...
Ah.
She had come through First Avenue, then she had booked it again, but in the meantime, she had exploded. That's one of the reasons why we built the Palace, so we could capture those kind of artists as they were, you know, emerging beyond the local nightclubs.
Plugs for the Palace, noted.
I'm gonna plug the
here.
Palace every okay. time. It's the greatest music
you're,
venue
you're being
ever.
The mayor, not just Chris Coleman.
No,
here.
No, that's pure music fan.
Okay.
It's just a great place. But it was kind of too big of a venue for her at the time. She wasn't used to that. And she was kind of doing, she was talking through the songs or in between songs. And you could tell she was uncomfortable with it. And then when kind of like the don't dance, Whitney, it's like, don't talk, sing. Mm-hmm. And then when she would sing, it was just amazing. I mean, cause she's got one of the greatest voices, you know, mm-hmm. in the modern era. And it's like, that's why you come there to hear him sing.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back in a minute to the confidence of the artist. Cause I think that's a thing, and you can see an artist grow in the confidence to manage big venues. But I don't want to miss what you were both saying about this experience of, I mean, and this has become a thing where you go to a performance and people are holding their phones up for the entire time to shoot it, or they're grabbing a shot and they're texting. With all the multitasking and all of the access to screens we've had, if we practice being present and in the moment for something like that very often, and whether we really see the value of it anymore. Ty, mm-hmm. what do you think?
I think that's a great question, in the sense that are we so busy with recording and maintaining things that we're missing what's happening in the moment? And not that I'm against, you know, technology, because I think the discovery of fire, you know, was great. but there's a way that maybe there are some things we aren't meant to record.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some things we're meant to remember. I think the Prince concert was in 2004, and like, to prepare, I kept Googling, trying to find reviews, and it was really hard. And I had to sit there and remember, right? And so, yeah, I think there is something about, if we can't be in the present moment, how can we engage with ourselves? And maybe a part of live music is working to facilitate that.
Do you think we've gotten less comfortable with that, because there's so much distraction and opportunity?
Well, you know, I want to be careful, because I think we can say, you know, we're less comfortable, but I also want to acknowledge I'm of a certain age. I've come up a certain way, where I look at my daughter, who's, you know, 15 years old, and over here, she's using her iPhone to search and Google and get things for me.
Yeah.
Maybe we think differently. Maybe we have changed, right?
So I was at that Prince concert in 2004, too, with Kathy Werzer. Right. And there are parts of that concert that and this is kind of rare, but that I specifically remember how he was singing and what we were doing when he was singing. That wouldn't have been the case if I had spent a lot of time grabbing a screenshot and then texting.
Absolutely. Out. And then how does your memory of that moment help inform who you are today.
Like absolutely.
There's a point in that concert where he had like a whole brass section and he had a tribute to James Brown.
Right.
And I was like, ooh, it just blew my mind.
Right.
Right. So now when I'm talking to my daughter and there's a riff that comes over in the song, I'm like, no, that's James Brown. Let's talk about the legacy of how things are connected, right? There's really nothing new. Everything built on something else, right? And if I had been recording that, which I'm not because I'm not tech savvy, yeah, I would have missed that. Absolutely.
Chris, what's the last concert that you can remember where you remember in the moment, you know, like being in the moment?
Just as recently as the Jazz Fest, you know, to see McCoy Tyner in Mears Park. And, you know, McCoy is like 130 years old, and I think he's got Alzheimer's and, you know, maybe had a stroke or something. And I, you know, I had a chance to talk with him because I'd seen McCoy in Greenwich Village in 87, and it was one of the most magical things I'd ever seen in my life in a small, you know, 100-seat bar. And
why? Will you describe what made, why do you say that, describe it like that?
First of all, you're seeing a legend in a small club in New York City, and I was fresh out of...
It was all about the surroundings
of
the moment.
Well, it was, and then, but you can't help but lose yourself in, you know, when he starts... tickling those ivories, you know, geez, you can't help but lose yourself in that. And it was just, it was amazing. And so fast forward to a couple of weeks ago in Mears Park, you know, in spite of his health challenges and in spite of his, you know, they put him in front of that piano. He sat down and he transformed, and that transformed the audience.
Wow.
And, you know, that was, there was nobody sitting there texting, tweeting through that, you know, maybe you took a quick shot of it just to, you know, to have that moment, but people were really, they were really there and they were present. And it was really cool. But I think it's, you know, one of the things for me that makes a live show particularly memorable is surprise. Like something happens that you don't expect it. Well, they're not just replaying the album as the album. So, I mean, they're not just kind of phoning it in.
Because there's a lot of bands, by the way, that are out doing this. The Moody Blues were in town, I think, recently, where they were doing that. They played an album all the way through.
Yeah.
Can there be surprises even in that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not that they're doing an album because Bruce just, you know, came through and he did The River. And he did it not necessarily in the exact order that it was on the album, but every song, you know, Bruce doesn't do a song.
Springsteen, for those Springsteen, of you wondering.
I'm sorry. I'm on a first name basis with Bruce.
Apparently so.
But I've seen him almost over 80 times
wow.
in concert. And that's hard to do. You know, if you're living in New York or New Jersey, that's not so hard. But when you're living in St. Paul and you see Bruce 80 times.
80 times?
Well, more than that.
Okay, so this is a great question. We're going to play a little Springsteen here in a minute. What do you think you're getting at concert 55 that you haven't already? I mean, can it ever be as good as it was the first two times you saw Bruce Springsteen live?
Yeah, because it's always different. I mean, that was, you know, I was asked one of my favorite. It's hard to say what are your top three favorites because you know there's so many great shows and every show has a different feel to it. But my dad wanted to see a rock and roll concert. He'd never been to one. Now, you said you're dating yourself because of a 2004 Prince concert.
I know.
I'm talking like 1977. my dad wanted to see, and this guy had just been on the cover of Time Magazine and Newsweek and was dubbed the future of rock and roll, and his name was Bruce Springsteen. Mm-hmm. So in November of 77, my dad took us all down. He got us tickets. He was kind of mad that he got such poor tickets. We were only 15th row center.
Jeez.
And Bruce walked out and played for 3 hours, and it was just, I mean, we were all exhausted. And I think that's one of the things. When you're exhausted walking out of a concert,
that's right.
Not just the artist, but when the spectator is exhausted, you know it's a good concert. And Bruce exhausts you every time you see him. You're just exhausted by what he's doing up there.
So here is a live concert, Bruce Springsteen in concert, I should say, singing Highway Patrolman. He happens to be in Glasgow. You might not have been at this show.
I was not in Glasgow.
There are some shows that Springsteen does.
I've seen him in Fargo. I've seen him in Toronto.
Here he is live. Let's listen.
My name's Joe Roberts. I work for the state. I'm a sergeant at Purdenville. Barracks number 8. I always done an honest job.
as honest as I could. Had a brother named Frankie. Frankie ain't no good. Ever since we was young kids, it's been the same come down. I get a call on a short way. Frankie's in trouble downtown. If it was any other man, I'd put him straight away. When it's your brother, sometimes you look the other way.
Okay, so we'll let this roll a little bit, but what do you sense is happening there, because it's live?
First of all, to point out, he's at a live, he's playing live in front of a big audience. There's probably 50,000 people there if it's Glasgow. And when he starts that song, the only sound you hear is his guitar and his voice.
Good point.
I mean, I have been in the XL Energy Center with 18,000 people where Bruce is playing, and if he's not making noise, you hear the air conditioner. And the next moment, those 18,000 fans or 50,000 fans will be screaming at the top of their lungs, singing Thunder Road. And the ability for him to bring the crowd up and bring it right back down, and they're with him. I mean, it's like a good preacher. And that's what Bruce is, a preacher. I mean, he is just telling the gospel. And when he brings you up, you're there, and then he brings you down. And that's, I've never seen anybody do it better. I've seen a lot of people that can do it well, but Bruce does it the best.
I think that's a great point. I mean, you know, I wasn't there in 77, but as I'm listening to the beautiful song, you're saying preacher. Yes, he's telling a story, right? It's a storyteller. And that music, as we listen to the musician, that's what they do. They connect us to that story, right? And then you're there. It's very beautiful.
Band played out of the Johnstown footer. Catch him when he's straight, like any brother would. Man turns his back on Spain, he just ain't no good.
I had a note about seeing Bruce Springsteen at Northrop. I'm sure you were at that show,
too. Close to Tom Joad.
Right.
Yep.
And my note here, which now that I realize doesn't really apply, because what I loved, it's one of my favorite concerts. He stripped away a lot of the dazzle. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in just hearing this, he probably had the whole E Street Band with him on this tour, too, right? The one that we just heard.
Yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't matter. I mean, there he is stripped down. So I was going to say, oh, it's all about the acoustics with Bruce Springsteen. But that's not really true. He has that power to do it both ways.
It's almost sacrilegious for me to say this, but the best Springsteen concert I ever saw was the Pete Seeger sessions. And it was a half bowl at the XL, and it wasn't even full. It wasn't sold out. So there were probably, you know, 5,000 people there. And he had, I think there were 18 pieces of brass on the stage. It wasn't the E Street Band. It was some of the best musicians I've ever seen. And he just went through the history of American music. And it was like people were out of their minds, crazy. And I feel sorry for any Springsteen fan or any music fan that didn't see that show.
Why did you say it was sacrilegious for you? Because it wasn't
the E Street Band.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
You know, it's hard to take anything away from that. I wouldn't even call it a Springsteen concert as much as it was just a American musical experience. And it was, and that's what's one of the reasons I love Bruce, is that he understands all the elements of American music, and he can bring it in different pieces, and mm-hmm. he appreciates all the different types of music. I mean, he's got his style, but he is a really, really knowledgeable musician about all genres of music.
You're listening to a Friday Roundtable inspired by a Rolling Stone story about the 50 greatest concerts, according to them. And we have asked, it's just a group of us. None of us are music professionals. We all just love going to concerts, and we love music, and we're sitting around in the studio here and talking about some favorite concerts. And I want to hear from you. Is there a single concert that stands above all others for you? You just heard the mayor talking about a Bruce Springsteen without the E Street Band, going through the American Songbook and how meaningful and moving that was. How about you? Tell me who, when, and where on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Ty, best concert or one of the best concerts for you, and why?
And before that, can I just say, sacrilegious, you don't have to say that. I think music is sacred.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like Prince would say, you're going to school, you're going to church, mm-hmm. you're going to learn. So I have to cheat a little bit. I think my favorite concert is Kendrick Lamar's 58th Grammy performance, and I cannot get it out of my head.
And why?
Well, he did a combination, and I hope I represent my 15-year-old well, and please note, but he does a combination of All Right and The Black of the Berry from his To Pimp a Butterfly CD, and then Untitled. And he's talking about the history of police brutality, the history of oppression.
This is on the Grammys.
Yes, on the Grammys. And it's at a time where, you know, what we're dealing with, right? Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Eric Gardner. He mentions Trayvon Martin specifically. And I'm there and I'm riveted. And then the camera shoots to the people in the audience and they're riveted. And everybody's like, oh my God, what is going on? And there's this sense that everybody knows it's sacred. There's something important happening. All eyes are on that performance. And then the teacher in me just was like, oh my God, this is important. And then I watched the YouTube clips. And so there are clips of people talking about the response to the performance and what it said about maybe this time and moment of what we had to think about in terms of our humanity, police brutality, or our own internal struggles with depression or addiction, right? I mean, he was just doing the whole line of what we struggle with, I think, today as human beings, these things that we carry through no fault of our own. And it's amazing. And it's something that for me, when I got the invitation, that was the first number one. So I'm not saying that I completely understand it, but I honor its sacredness. I listen to it over and over again. And let me be clear. I don't listen to the recording on the CD. I listen to the live performance.
Okay.
Because there's something that he does differently, the spontaneity, right, that he does that completely speaks to me and I think speaks to a lot of people about, hey, we need to figure this out. And it's almost like a record, right? He leaves this kind of piece of evidence for us to kind of let me help you out of this darkness, right? So that's my top one.
Here's Kendrick Lamar at the Grammys.
Sure you will agree. Been feeling this way since I was 16. Come to my senses. You never liked this anyway. Pump your friendship, I meant it. I'm African American. I'm African. I'm black as the moon. Heritage of a small village. Part of my residence. Came from the bottom of mankind. My hair is nappy. You know that it's big. My nose is round and wide. You hate me, don't you? You hate my people. Your plan is to terminate my culture. You know you're evil. I want you to recognize that I'm a proud monkey. You vandalize my perception, but can't take down from it. And this is more than destruction. I mean, I might press the button, so you know my discretion. Caught in my feelings, I know that you feel it. Savage like my community, making a killing. You made me a killer, emancipation of a real hitter. Huh. As we proceed to give you what you
Ty, tell me what you hear in that. We'll let it roll a little bit here.
Absolutely. I'll quote one line he says at the end. He says, why would you want to see a good man with a broken heart? And I think he's trying to express the sense of anger, of brokenness, of what's happening to citizenship and access for marginalized people through telling the story of his identity as an African-American. And I think he's continuing that lineage of the sacred tradition of live music in the African-American tradition, from Negro spirituals to jazz to gospel to R&B to hip hop. He's continuing that thread and using the live medium performance to go to church, so to speak, to have a commentary on class and violence in America.
It's an amazing performance, but the line that gives me just a chill up my back is where he talks about the shape of his nose, and given that the officer that pulled over Philando Castillo said, I'm pulling him over because of the shape of his nose. I mean, that's haunting. And that's what music can do, live recorder, whatever it is. My brother's a musician, and you know, I grew up in a political family, and I chose kind of the elected route. My brother chose to exercise his politics through his music, and he started with third world reggae, world beat music. It was all about politics for him. It wasn't about, you know, just out getting out there and playing love songs or whatever. It was about the power of music to rally people, to direct, you know, to direct them, to get them fired up, and to get them active in a cause. And I mean, you're just hearing the master of it.
Right, but also to save you. I mean, I have to say that the level of frustration I felt, you know, I love my country, but I'm also African-American. I'm a daughter of a cop, but I have a 5-year-old black boy. And I just, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people were feeling that way, not just African-Americans. And his music was cathartic. I listened to it and it helped me heal. Not that I have all the answers, but it helped me to say, okay, step back. We're going to get through this, right? And he has a line. He says, it's going to be all right. We're going to be all right. And yes, I know it's hard, but we're going to get through it, right?
Well, I do listen to a lot of people besides Bruce Springsteen. But what Bruce did after 9/11 with the Rising
with the
album,
Rising.
It was said that same thing. Everything's going to be all right. It's all right. It's all right. And that, you know, that is exactly right.
Absolutely. To tell the truth, right? To provide the commentary, to talk about injustice, but still say, we're going to be okay, and to express that. And I think about that as a recovering Catholic, which I call myself, but still African-American, so grew up in the gospel tradition. So you go to church every Sunday, there's live music. So that music is live, but it's also about healing. It's also about expression and coming together. And among the infinite things this song does and did for me, it was that.
You know, the other thing that occurs to me in listening to you two talk about it, too, is what Kendrick Lamar is saying about identity, the difficult things that we have to reckon with on identity, is palatable in some, right? That audience, you said, it's a powerful thing when the camera turns on the audience and the audience is in a way that maybe some kind of lecture on identity would never have that kind of effect. We will, I think, in some ways, accept it in a forum like this in a way that maybe we wouldn't, you know, a debate in the political arena,
right,
on
and
identity.
And that's what music does, and not to marginalize the political debate or arena, but music as a vehicle maybe can do things that other things cannot. And I would say specifically hip-hop, right? So it's not just that it's Kendrick Lamar, it's a live performance, but he's also using rap and hip-hop as a vehicle that maybe hip-hop is the only medium that can contain the contradictions and the violence and the struggles of what we're going through now.
Let's ask the politician about that. Do you think that's right?
On so many different levels. And you know, I think that what you're saying, you know, just it speaks to people. And I don't limit it to hip hop, but there is something that is just absolutely it, because it's kind of music and spoken word, mm-hmm. it kind of rhymed into one. I mean, you are definitely, it is about the message, and it is very clear, and it's done in a way that kind of makes you feel it as well as hear it and think about it. I think it's, I mean, just the power of music. You know, you'll see at concerts people just bawling during the very songs. I play bagpipes and. You know, you want to get somebody crying, play Amazing Grace on the bagpipes, you know, and I've been at...
Even if they've heard it, right, a dozen times, right?
So I, you know, I remember I was in a, we were in a, at an event over at McAllister and you know, the band struck in Amazing Grace and I literally watched people in the audience just kind of fall backwards and start to cry mm-hmm. because the power of that, those mm-hmm. sounds... Maybe the bagpipes are out of tune. It might have been part of it, but just that power of music and, mm-hmm. and what Kendrick Lamar did at the Grammys or what Bruce did after 9/11 or, I mean, it just there's something that you know a great speech can transform and can get people you know going, but you connect it to that just kind of instinctive you know feeling
absolutely
with music.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I don't think it's limited just to hip-hop as a medium. But I do think, you know, a nerd moment, it's important to note, right? In the 70s, you have this art form, American art form, that comes out of the boroughs of New York, Latino and black people of hip-hop, that expresses their oppression, their identity, their marginalization. And then it takes off around the world. So now it doesn't matter what you look like, what your ethnicity is, your gender, how you show up. But the fact that that medium, anywhere you go in the world, becomes a vehicle for marginalized people to express their identity and their beauty, et cetera, et cetera. And I think in some ways it's the very definition of what live is, right? Because hip-hop comes out of you have to do it live or you can't do it at all, right? So, yeah, it is interesting, and I'm excited to see where live music goes, where live performances go. So,
you're listening to a Friday Roundtable. It's the Coleman Friday Roundtable here. We're talking about... Wow, I love where this conversation has gone. We started out talking about best concerts that we've seen because Rolling Stone came up with this list of 50 greatest concerts. But then we're talking about being in the moment, that experience of being witness with one another in a performance that is transformational. And Chris Coleman is here. Yep, the mayor of St. Paul. And Ty Coleman is here. Yep, a professor of English literature. And we're talking about having those moments. And I want to hear from you as well. Is there a single concert that stands as transformational above all others for you, for all the reasons that we're talking about this hour? Tell me who, when, and where, and maybe why, if you can slip that in on Twitter. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. We'll get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. Harvey, Illinois is offering 10 free houses to Texans who have lost their homes to the storm with which the Chicago suburb shares its name. Sean Howard, a spokesman for the city, says volunteer tradesmen and carpenters are going to prepare the homes for the new residents. Renovations could take about 6 weeks. The city acquired the homes due to unpaid taxes. Instead of selling the properties to investors, Harvey, Illinois is making them permanently available to Harvey storm victims. Gasoline prices rose several cents overnight amid continuing concerns about shortages in parts of Texas and several other states in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. The American Automobile Association says the national average for a gallon of regular gasoline rose in one day from $2.45 a gallon to $2.52. At least two major pipelines have been slowed or stopped because of flooding and damage in Texas. Harvey is now a post-tropical cyclone about 100 miles southeast of Paducah, Kentucky. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow will prepare a tough response to the U.S. decision to shut down its consulate in San Francisco. The U.S. has ordered Russia to shut its San Francisco consulate and close offices in Washington and New York within 48 hours in response to Russia's decision last month to cut U.S. diplomatic staff in Russia. Lavrov says Moscow will have a tough response to the things that come totally out of the blue to hurt us. And U.S. job growth slowed in August as employers added 156,000 jobs, but even that weaker pace suggests that business remained confident in an economy now in its ninth year of recovery from the Great Recession. The Labor Department says the unemployment rate ticked up to 4.4% last month. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:43.
It's NPR Day at the State Fair. Stop by and say hi. Today only, we're set up at the big stage at Dan Patch Park. Water on a stick, music, cool interviews, free gifts for members, and more. We'd love to see you while you're at the Great Minnesota Get-Together.
Programming is supported by the Energy Fair, September 9th and 10th at Harriet Island Park in St. Paul, with more than 80 workshops and 60 exhibits focused on sustainability. Featuring live music and family activities, rides from Metro Transit included. TheEnergyFair.org.
Programming is supported by the Minnesota Orchestra, presenting La La Land in concert. Watch the complete film starring Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling while the orchestra performs the soundtrack live. September 30th through October 1st. Tickets at minnesotaorchestra.org.
This is B.B. King from 1971, live at the Cook County Jail, the recording that was made from that concert. Rolling Stone put it on their list of top 50 concerts, and that's inspired the roundtable today as we talk about why, what it is about being in the room that's transformational in a musical performance. Ty Coleman with us from St. Kate's, Chris Coleman, yep, the mayor of St. Paul, and we're talking about the concerts that we've experienced and why they stand above all the other performances that we've seen. Ty and Chris, this interesting quote from B.B. King from Rolling Stone about that experience of being at Cook County Jail. "I couldn't help but feel the oppression, My heart was heavy with feeling for the guys behind bars. And, you know, it made me wonder if there is something about taking performers out of their usual performance venues that's transformational for them. Have either of you ever seen a concert where that happens?
Absolutely. And it gets to, like, this quantum physics thing, right? Because you think B.B. King is playing, but he's playing with the listeners, right? They become one organism, right? Nothing independent is happening in the room. So it's never going to be quite the same.
Right.
So at the Memorial Street Party this past summer for First Avenue for Prince, which was sponsored by The Current, they were all local artists. But, you know, Twin Cities, we have local national artists. So it was so cool. And I performed a poem, which I was so humbled and excited to do. And that concert was amazing. The performers were just fantastic, but it was the interaction with the crowd. They knew all the words. They enhanced the feeling. They determined how the musicians would play. They determined the songs that the singers would sing or what notes they would hit or whether or not they would repeat themselves. It was interactive. We became like one organism right there outside on the side of First Ave. So, yes, I do think it's different, right? Because it's never going to be recreated. So B.B. King, I'm sure, performed at millions of venues, but every single one was different and unique because of the people in the crowd are different and unique.
Where's the concert that was out of the usual venue for you?
Well, I got two B.B. King stories, but I first of all, I'll circle back. I mean, it's Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison,
yeah,
right? I mean,
right.
What that was transformative too, and that was because he was channeling the anger and the oppression and everything else that his audience was feeling, and the best performers are feeding off of their audience, regardless of the circumstances. And when I was a kid working in the Tetons one summer, a friend of mine, you know, ran into him and he said, I got this blues festival. I didn't know much about blues. I was like 19 years old. And so I went down to Salt Lake City and sat on the side of a mountain, and John Lee Hooker comes out and starts playing. And I'm like 10 feet away from John Lee Hooker. I'm going, this is pretty cool. And then B.B. gets up and plays. And it was the most amazing thing. And I wasn't going to tell the story because it will sound really like kind of a little haughty. But so I got invited to a celebration of the blues at the White House a few years ago. It was B.B. King, Buddy Guy, Tedeschi Trucks. It was Booker T. And, you know,
how in the heck did you get, this is the Obamas inviting this, right?
Yeah, no.
How'd you get that invitation?
Well,
it sounds good.
It sounds good, but I was, Connie and I were in the last row, the third row. We're sitting behind the president.
Where the last row is the third row.
The last row. I mean, there's like 200 people in this room.
Wow.
And then all of a sudden, the door in the corner, it's in the East Room, the door in the corner opens up and Mick Jagger struts in.
Wow.
That was the one, you may remember the...
Are you sure you didn't dream this?
No.
This really happened?
The video where they made Obama get up and sing Sweet Home Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I was like 5 feet away from that.
Wow.
And that was, I mean, that just still sends chills up my spine. But, I mean, it was the blues. And actually, one of my favorite Rolling Stone quotes, when they were first traveling in the United States, people would like, where did you get that music? Where did you get that sound? And they're like, you idiots. That's American music that I'm playing.
Right.
You dummies.
You don't know your musical history.
They didn't even know their own music. And so,
What did Jagger do that night, given what you've just said and about the history of the blues?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember?
The songs that he played?
I'm just curious that kind of company, what do you play?
You know, it's funny because there are... You really kind of understood, like, there are stars and then there are superstars.
Mm-hmm.
And Jagger is a superstar. Like, and then afterwards, you know, you're mingling with all these folks and getting a chance to talk to Jeff Beck and, you know, and everybody. And then Jagger comes into the room and everybody just loses their mind. And they almost crushed him. They were so, there's a long story I could share with you. But it was magical. And he when he got on that stage, even though he was Jagger, he was part of this ensemble of incredible musicians.
Right.
And it was just, you know, it's just even hard to put into words because
so,
it was, and then to have, and especially, you know, playing blues with an African American president who gets up and sings "Sweet Home
I'm
Chicago."
I'm glad you said it because I was going to say it.
You know, and just like it was historic,
it really changes the music. I imagine the music changed because of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's when he got up and sang in South Carolina at that funeral, when he sang at the memorial service. You know, I'm with all respect to the president because I don't have the best voice either, but. You know, he got up there and he said, "Doesn't matter. Mm. It's not about my voice. It's about the music, and it's about what this conveys."
Right.
That actually should go down as one of the best concerts of all time.
Absolutely,
when the president sang that song.
Right. What the music does to connect. Yeah, I like that you pointed it out because, you know, what is rock and roll without blues? Right. Mm. It's all connected. But how I think we started our conversation, we think we are separated, but we really are connected.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean the other thing that this reminds me of is what happens sometimes. I'm not a big fan of those pop fest or music festivals because I feel like you get desensitized by the third group and the experience isn't all that. But I think something happens when musicians are in the presence of other extraordinary musicians, and you get the opportunity to see performances. You know, when some I'm thinking back, even something like Woodstock, right? When some group is in the presence of the other legends, something changes for those performers too.
But, you know, this goes to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right, yeah.
My Guitar Gently Weeps, and all of a sudden Prince comes out.
Right.
And all these incredible musicians just practically got down on their knees and bowed to the master because, you know, Prince and Jagger, the people that were at that level. And then he just gives the most amazing performance, throws a guitar up in the air. It never comes down. They have no idea whatever happened to the guitar, and he walks off the
stage.
Yeah,
it went to heaven, right?
It went to heaven.
Yeah. But don't you think that's an example of that, right? This happens when you're in the presence of people that are your peers or the people that you idolize.
Well, I once, you know, and again, dating, so I don't have the Woodstock, but I think it was like MC Hammer and Boyz II Men.
It's hammer time.
I know. I'm the young blood in the room, relatively speaking, right?
Yeah.
And I think Boyz II Men went on first, and then MC Hammer came on. And, you know, he's like the super aerobics workout from hell. But, I mean, he totally threw down. So you're right. I mean, it was the best performance because one tried to up the other, and not a sense of, like, jealousy, but just, like, competition and respect, right? Mm-hmm. When you come,
right.
bring your A game.
Right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Absolutely.
So we have a little Prince queued up, and since we've talked about Prince a lot, but we haven't heard any Prince.
Yeah, Prince, we're not worthy.
We gotta listen to Prince live and what happens when he's live. Ty, what do you hear happening in that?
The improvisation and the guitar riff. And I'm thinking of Jimi Hendrix, right? And thinking of the connections. And just, he's invited me to go on a journey with him. And he totally controls it. And yes, I'm going. I'm with you.
That song in this version of it is so completely different than the studio
Absolutely.
Version. I mean, he's telling a totally different story
right.
than he tells in the exact same song in a different circumstance.
Right.
I mean, you can feel it in his voice, how he changes the intonation, you know, and I don't know what was hitting him at the time, but it was something.
And he does it every time, right? He never performs a live song the way it's recorded.
That's such a great point. So that's one of the other things about a performance. We get to see the artist in the moment and the artist having the kind of experience that they're going to have that's different from day to day, right? From performance to performance.
But you have a greater respect for the artist because then they really show their range, right?
Right.
And not that I'm knocking recordings, but they're just that one recording. When you see them live, you like see all the stuff they really can do. And you're like, oh, my God, it's just a greater respect for their art and their gift.
Yeah, this is the test, right?
Yes.
Of what a musician
and sometimes they use their live performance to reconstruct a song to say, look at you missed the point.
That's right.
And,
right.
Like Born in the USA, you know, which became this jingoistic
it's back
thing.
To Springsteen.
It all comes back to, but that's just a classic because at the end of the day, you know, we're using this tune as this jingoism. You know, America's great. He goes, no, that's not what that song was about, and so. When he would sing it live, he would bring it down so raw and so powerful. Mm. He's like, you can't mistake what this song is about now.
Right. The mutability of the work, right? Mm-hmm. I once saw Chaka Khan live at an expo here in the Twin Cities. And of course, you know, I came like, you know, I'm every woman, you know, I feel for you. Like I had my songs. And she was like, no, that's not my favorite song. She was like, this is my favorite song. Right. And, you know, and at first she wanted to resist. But of course, it's Chaka Khan. Mm-hmm. She starts blowing.
No one is going to argue with Chaka
Khan. Thank you.
Khan.
Right? But you're right. There's a sense of, it's about their work and what they think it is, and you let go, especially if they're great and they take you there. Yeah.
So we're going to close with Born in the USA, the live version. What do you want to say about it as an undying Bruce fan?
I think, you know, in a lot of ways it was kind of the first, I mean, was when Bruce went kind of over the top in terms of his stardom. And he, you know, up to that point, obviously he was big and he had a cult following, you know, or a huge following, but this kind of took him into a thing. But it was about, what I love about it is that, and it's not my favorite Springsteen song, but I do love this song because it is about the gritty, like it is Bruce taking who he was from the beginning, you know, sweating out in the streets of a runaway American dream, which I think was one of the greatest lines of all time in music. But saying this is the American experience for a lot of folks, and it is gritty and it's raw, but we're doing it I'm taking it in a way that can appeal to a broad cross section of folks.
Right, and I know the song too, and I think it's appropriate, right? And all this layered and complex way of what it means to be an American. I'm not being nationalistic here. I think it's appropriate because at the end of the day, we are Americans, and it is ours, and it's what we make of it, no matter where we come from.
Coleman's,
yes,
thanks much.
Such a pleasure.
Awesome.
Come back and do it again.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you.
Programming supported by the Shakopee Mettawakaton Sioux community, home of one of the Midwest's largest green roofs, a biomass heat and power plant, an organics recycling facility, and other earth-friendly programs to protect our lands and waters for the next seven generations.